uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being here with us tonight for another live edition of the broadcast. It is Tuesday edition of the show, January the 24th, 2012, now into Wednesday, January the 25th, 2012. And so glad you could be with us here tonight for another live late night edition of the broadcast. Audio starts being weird again, as always, but glad you could be here with us. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. That's TheGlobalReality.com, and if you're listening live right now, it's probably where you found the way to listen live from that website. So please spread that around. Tell people about the show. Tell people about when we're live. We're generally live, we're somewhere around midnight Central Standard Time. Lately, I've been pushing the shows a little bit, just because I'm putting stuff together and working on the show and you know, weeding stuff out. A little, you know, I'm actually taking a little bit more time to do some editing of things. So sometimes I just grab a bunch of stuff, and then I get up here and I go, I don't want to fucking talk about that. Why did I even grab that to even talk about? So trying to take care of some of that ahead of time. We love to have emails from you in lieu of having phone calls, any of that garbage. I just hate phone calls, and I hate having to deal with it. So it just eats up time, too. Excuse me. GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. That's GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. That's where you can send in emails. You can send those in live tonight. If you're listening live, you have questions, comments, anything, you can send them in, and I'll do my best to read them on air for you. And always do my best to respond either on air or writing back. I'll sometimes can't do both, but I do try to do one or the other. So if I don't respond to you, don't take it personally. I just, you know, I try to hit everybody, but sometimes I can't get to everybody. That's just the way it is. Secret Right Volume 2, my newest film, is out. And it's on Blu-ray and DVD, and there's all kinds of packages up there. You can get the different packages with the research packs and the additional 4.2 gig research DVD, data DVD for your computer that has pictures and extra video and all kinds of extra stuff like that. And you can also get Blu-ray packages with that, with the soundtrack and different discs. It's all up there under the Buy SR2 tab. We also have a tab there that says Books, and those have all the... although a lot of the books that I've read, it's got Lost Book of Enki up there, Emerald Tablets of Thoth, all the rest of it. It's got all the different, those are audiobooks where one of our listeners had taken all the different shows that those encompassed and edited those down into an audiobook format so that people can download those and listen to them. So they're up there. Those are for that's a free service right there. I mean, that's, you know, that's just getting the message out and getting the word out. So there's lots of free stuff up there on my website. Now, you know, I've put everything I've ever put out for free, everything I've ever done, I put it out for free. And eventually, I may put out the Secret Right Volume 2 for free, but that's gonna be at my discretion. It's gonna be for a while, because it's one of those things where it just, it has to be that way this time. It's just the way it is. It used to be that you had to, you know, you had to buy something to watch it to see if you liked it or not. You know, not this thing where I'm just going to download it, you know. I don't agree with any of this piracy bullshit that's going on, but I do see it from the standpoint of an artist. You know, it's the artist always, I don't care if you're a musician or what it is, filmmaker, you're always the lowest on the totem pole. You always get fucked the most. And it's always other people who make, you know, the most off of what you do. So I'm trying to find ways around that, you know. Because inadvertently, people, when I put something out for free, other people make money off that. You're retarded if you think that they don't. They do. Because when I put up a movie for free, somebody who doesn't have the same scruples as I do, who will, you know, take every snake oil and dick pill and Jew gold sponsor they can get and slap all their banner ads and that horse shit all over their website. Well, somebody that has a website like that that doesn't have the same scruples that I do will take my film in its entirety and post it up on their website. And when people go to search for it to find it, they'll find it on some Yahoo's website that has all these different things, and then they get hits and traffic from that, folks. They make money off of that. And I don't see a dime from it, from putting it out there for free. You see my standpoint on this? I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've seen my videos posted on these websites where I wouldn't, you know, I mean, it's not really anything I can say about that. If it's out there, it's out there, you know. People can do what they want to do with it after that. And so that creates things where, you know, maybe you don't want that. You don't want that situation to be there. And I just find it unbelievable that people don't believe that somehow it's not my right to be able to put my films out the way I want to put them out. That's just unbelievable to me that people would have that sort of attitude. You bunch of hypocrites. I thought you guys were into all this horse shit because you wanted, you know, you didn't want somebody stepping on your liberties and your freedoms and your rights. Well, don't step on my rights. It's my right to put my films out any way I want to put them out. If you don't like that, then go on down the road. But it's my right to do it the way I want to do it. I just love the hypocrisy when it comes to this stuff, man. You know, every time I've made a movie, it's been, you know, making another one be damned. Just put this one out for free and fuck everything else. That's what it's always been. I'm just not going to give into that this time. It's the way it is. And I'm working on trying to get the next film done by July, but, you know, that's that was the goal I'd set, but it's probably not going to happen. Because we don't have the cash to do it. I need to go travel to get some of the footage for this stuff, and we hadn't met our goal this month yet, so that's, you know, that's going to be up in the air on that. I don't know. We have to have a budget for this thing. We've got quite a few wild and crazy news stories here tonight. Let me see if we have some. I think I had something. I had a pretty good. Let's see what kind of emails we have. I think we had a couple of nice emails. Hi, Josh. I have an interesting question regarding Mystic Politics. Was the show ever on the Oracle Broadcasting or Blog Talk Radio? I'm not really sure for sure. I don't really know. I think it was on Blog. I think it was on Blog Talk Radio. It wasn't on Oracle. Also, does the GCN model for alternative radio networks will prevent any format similar to what you had at Oracle in the past? I don't really understand what that means. Does the alternative radio networks will prevent any format? I don't really understand that question. I'm thinking of setting up a radio show later this year during the summer or autumn when I've got more time on my hands. I would love to know and research more about the topics you discussed. Do you require a certain hardware to do radio shows on various formats? P.S. I'm thinking means I might not do a show at all, but at the moment it's a hypothetical idea. Well, it just depends on how you're going to do it. I mean, if you're going to do... You could do like Blog Talk Radio thing, and you can, you know, that you don't really get jack shit for their free account. But if you pay up and get like the $50 one or whatever, you can get, you know, It's kind of shite. I didn't like it though. I didn't like the audio quality of it. So I went and started and got my own stream. It just depends on what you want to do, Mark. I mean, you can do everything from, get yourself a cheap a headset microphone, computer microphone. Headset microphone combo thing, and plug it straight into your computer, and you can go download Audacity for free offline and just configure it to pull all the audio off of your sound card and record it into Audacity and sit there and talk and do your show all day long and edit it, and you can upload that to a download site somewhere that hosts MP3s. You can upload that, start yourself a free blog website, and hot link to everybody in your Facebook account. Give everybody the link, pass it around. I mean, you don't even have to spend any money to do it, Mark, if you don't really want to. I mean, but again, it just depends on what, all this stuff. And one of the biggest things that you encounter when you do this stuff, no matter how long you've been doing it, it doesn't matter. One thing you always encounter is, what level do you want to play on? And, if you want to play in the minor leagues, Bush leagues, you can get yourself a headset microphone and, an Audacity for free. You don't have to really spend any money. If you already have a microphone and a headset for your computer, then hey, you don't have to spend any money. Go download Audacity. Go start yourself a WordPress blog somewhere. Find a place that hosts MP3s for free. They're all over the web. Record your show, put it up for free, spread your link around, and boom, you got yourself a platform. There you go. You didn't have to do anything. Or if you want to play with the big boys, you can go, plunk down a few hundred dollars. If you got some money to spend, you'll plunk down a few hundred dollars, get yourself a Shoutcast stream and a server like I do, and get yourself Sam Broadcaster and, start doing real broadcasting and buy yourself streams and pay for your bandwidth and have your hosting of your stuff every month. I mean, it's all this, no matter what you do, I find this in music as well. No matter what you do, what level you're going to play at is going to be depend upon how many funds you have. And the more funds you have, the higher the level you can play at. And that's all there is to it. It's not about talent. It's not about how good you are. It's not about, integrity or honesty. It's not about, everybody goes out there and gives it their best shot and does the best they can and the best man wins. It's not about that at all. He who has the most coin goes the farthest. And that's the way it is. And so that was a problem for me with my last film, with this last film, The Secret Volume 2, is that I knew from Jump Street, before I even made the film, that this film needed to compete and needed to play at a different level than I'd been playing it up to this point, strictly because this information is too important to languish in obscurity. And I still feel that way, and I'm still trying to work towards remedying that for this film. I don't want to, yes, I'm working on the next film, but I'm not going to give up pushing this film until I feel like it's been adequately given its day in court. And so that's why it was such an arduous task of making the film for the past couple of years and having enough funding and whatnot to get it done. It's just because, again, when the level of, what you're trying to reach gets higher, well, so does the amount of money it's going to cost you to get there. I want this thing to play at the highest level I can get it to play at. And the highest level I can get it to play at right now is iTunes and Netflix, which will reach millions of people, folks, millions. And, people go on Netflix and iTunes and just watch shit just 'cause. All the time. You know it. I know it. I see people do it all the time. You see people do it all the time. You do it all the time. I do it all the time. And that costs $1,600 to do that. But, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is I would love to, if there were other avenues and other ways that you could get a film like this out to that many people, I would explore it. But everything in all industries now is pay to play. Everything. We got an email, I don't know, about a year or so ago. We got an email for Ben the Demigods. From I forget the guy's name, but he was one of the biggest radio promoters in the country. He's, you know, he gets everybody on the radio, and he sent us this email saying that he could get one of our songs played once on every single major top 40 clear channel station in America. Once, one time, eight grand gets you one play, one time, one shot. You want multiples, you can pay multiple $8,000 prices. But that's how it goes. Again, it's not about talent. It's not about how good you are. It's not about your message. It's about how much money there is to go into what you're doing. And that's why people like Alex Jones and Glenn Beck and all these clowns are allowed to come up as high as they do, because it's very obvious now, if you do the research, they have people in high places funding them and funneling money through them to put out an alternative viewpoint that's alternative to the mainstream, yet still does not fully diverge the true identity of the conspirators. This has been going on for quite some time. And, if you don't take anything else away from the Secret Volume 2, I hope you take that away from it. And I hope you understand how important that is. So, yeah, Mark. I mean, again, buddy, it just, you know, from the time you start to 10 years from now, if you're going to start doing a radio show, dude, it's going to always be that question. You know, and... honestly, after playing at the same exact level for 3, 4, 5 years, since the Secret Wrong Volume 2 and on till now, I'm tired. I'm done playing at that low level anymore. I'm doing everything I can to take this to the next level, but I have to have help doing it. I can't do it on my own. I'm a one-man machine over here. So that's where our listening audience comes in, and I thank everybody for that. So thanks, Mark. I appreciate your email, man. And I hope you do start your own show, dude. You should. Why not? Like I said, you don't have to spend any money to do it. Headset, you know, you can gradually, if you get good at it and you don't have an audience and it goes well for you, upgrade your stuff eventually. You know, you don't have to spend a lot of money out of the gates. If you know, certainly don't do it if you think you're not going to stick with it 3 months from now. But start out something small. And I mean, when I started out on radio, I did 1 hour, 4 days a week. And within 2 months of being on air, I went to a 3-hour show, afternoon show. I was doing a 6 p.m. Monday through Thursday, 1 hour. I did that, you know, but that's what got me started. And set yourself a goal like that. You know, you don't have to start out of the gate saying, I'm going to do a fucking, you know, 4-hour overdrive marathon broadcast, you know, 6 days a week right out of the gates. You know, you can start out and do 1 hour one day a week, or 2 hours one day a week, or 3 hours one day a week, or 1 hour 5 days a week, whatever you want to do. Start out small. Because the one thing that you got to be careful of, and I love watching hosts do this to themselves, and I ran into this myself, but luckily I had so much info on the back burners for years of researching that I wasn't stuck. But one of the most amusing things to watch for an up and coming new jack radio host, I love this shit, it's so fucking funny, is to watch these, whoever they are, guy, girl, doesn't matter. And you can always tell who's done the most research and who really knows their shit by this right here. When somebody starts a show for an undefined period of time, some people it might be a month, 2 weeks, a week, a day, 2 days, some sad cases. But, you know, when you start doing your new show, eventually you've blown your load, right? And what I mean by blown your load is you've successfully regurgitated every possible piece of information you've come across up to this point in time regarding this stuff since you've been researching before you started your radio show. And then one day you go on air and you realize, oh shit, I don't have anything to talk about today. That happened to me about a month in to doing it. And maybe not even that much, but maybe about a month. I just completely ran out of stuff to talk about. And then I, you know, found out, well, right about that time, I was finding out about the CMP stuff too. So that got me going on that. And then I started talking about, because when I first started doing this, it was like really taboo, even on like the radio station I was on at the time, TrueNet Radio. It was taboo to even talk about secret societies and Freemasonry stuff back then when I first started. You believe that? I'm not kidding you, it was. I remember when I first, it was right in November. I'd been on air a couple of months. When I first did this whole show about Freemasonry, my dad was listening to that show too. And he said it was fantastic. But I just kind of said, fuck it, you know, and went on this whole big tirade about Freemasonry, and my numbers were just started shooting up. And I started noticing that every time I would talk about, when I just talk about news or I just talk about whatever, the numbers would be at one place. As soon as I'd start talking about deeper information, the listenership would just start shooting up instantaneously. So, that was, after that, I didn't really second guess myself as far as what I was going to talk about on air anymore. That was the confirmation for me of, you know, because I was kind of, you know, skeptical to do that at first because I peer pressure and people really saw that as taboo stuff. And so I just said, fuck it. You know, the numbers are going up. That's what I'm going with. And so I went with that, and it got me the title of being, you know, being the guy that covers the weird stuff and talking about moon bats. So that's where that term, that where we re-hijacked that term moon bat, where that comes from. And you can always tell when these hosts, they'll run out of gas, they'll run out of stuff to talk about. And a lot of them will quit. A lot of them will just rehash the same old stuff over and over again. But you know, that may happen to you. You know, you may do a month's worth of shows and then realize, well, shit, I don't have anything else to say, so I don't think I want to do a show anymore. But, hey, you know, it never hurt to try, and I wish you all the luck in the world, my friend, so definitely give it a shot. This was from John. He says, hi, Josh, I'm a great fan of the show. I was wondering if you saw this story. Yes, I have seen that story. I'm not going to mention it yet because I'm going to get into it here in a bit. Also, I had a question about Ron Paul. You talked about Chuck Baldwin the other night, but we keep hearing about a brokered convention this year. Rumor has it that they want no one to get enough delegates so they can slip in Jeb Bush. What are your thoughts on that? Wouldn't surprise me. I don't know. I don't really care. I'm just really focusing on what these guys are specifically, the Jeb Bush thing, I don't know anything about, honestly. Also, based on your research, what is the significance of King Darius? I mean, Jeb Bush said he was no way he was going to be involved in anything. He wasn't going to run for president or any of that. So are you saying they're saying he might be like a dark horse or something coming, might slip him in the back door? Maybe so. It wouldn't surprise me. You know, if none of the rest of these dog and pony show candidates will, you know, step and see Heil and say, yes, I, to the Masters, and Jeb Bush will, then, you know, yeah. Because that's, like I talked about this recently on the show, that's exactly what happened, 10, 11 years ago, 12 years ago, now, when Bush W first got in there, the Republican Party, they didn't have a candidate. And Bush really didn't have a lot of support. And then they had a CMP meeting in San Antonio, and he, you know, stepped and nodded to all their requests, and boom, you know, he gets the nomination. So, absolutely. It says also, based on your research, what is the significance of King Darius and Cyrus and the Order of Light of the Aryans to secret societies such as Freemasonry? Awesome shows, John. Yeah, well, I actually know a lot about that, John. to really sum it up for you, because it's one of those things I could go on about all night. To sum it up for you, if you listened to last night's show, John, and if you didn't, go back and definitely go back and check it out. The end section of the show last night, we were reading from Zachariah Sitchin's The End of Days, and we will be reading more from that here tonight as well. But last night, John, some of the stuff we were reading about in there talked about the bloodlines and talked about, you know, how these bloodlines became to rule, and how you had the priest class, and you had the the blue bloods, you had the demigod royal bloodlines. Well, that's essentially what King Darius was. One of those, he was a demigod. He was divine. He was of the gods, of the lineages. He may have been a full blown Anunnaki. I'm really not for sure. I don't have all the information on that yet. But we'll say this. And I found out about this, John, by a few years ago by doing research, trying to find, if they're going into Iraq for all these antiquities, where would they be going next? And when I said, okay, Iran, they want to go in Iran. Well, what kind of antiquity shit do they have in Iran? Well, they have something called the Behistun inscription in Iran. And it's this gigantic, it's almost impassable to get to. And it's carved into solid rock. And it's a giant inscription from King Darius. And when you research King Darius, it's amazing. He was the precursor to all the bloodlines that exist throughout the world today. He was the precursor to Merovinius Merovi, that later spawned the Merovinian bloodline. Darius came from this. And so, if you're talking about the Bushes or, Obama or any of these bloodlines, the royals, they all go back to Darius. And yes, King Darius, people forget that Iranian means Aryans. The original people that inhabited that land were the white-skinned Caucasoids from the Caucasus Mountains. And those were the ones that were said to have been fused with the most Anunnaki DNA during their genetic experiments. But yes, those were the Aryans that Hitler was looking for, absolutely. And so King Darius, on the sign of this Behistun inscription, on the sign of this giant rock in the mountain, talked about, and you can go and look this up, Behistun, I think it's B-E-H-I-S-T-U-N, Behistun inscription, I think is how you spell that. And he talks about, all my bloodline descendants, all my family will rule over these 23 lands forever. And all these 23 lands have these weird, crazy names. And you go look these all these weird and crazy things up, and you start going, well, isn't that interesting? All my people will own these lands and rule over these lands forever. And all these 23 lands just happen to be all the areas in the Middle East, the biblical lands, all the places where the oil is, all this stuff. All the ancient, Jerusalem, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, on and on and on. And you look at that and you go, my God, they inscribed this, etched this into the solid rock. And you wonder why all the wars and Blackwater and the Crusaders and all these guys are doing all this stuff in the Middle East. These white Aryans that were the original inhabitants of Iran, the people that are in Iran now are considered a mongrel people. Why do you think they wanted to go back and take over Iraq and Iran? Folks, these guys in charge, they believe that this land is theirs because of what this demigod, or even perhaps god or extraterrestrial, King Darius, decreed on the Behistun inscription on a giant rock, which, by the way, is inscribed at the bottom to Zeus. Zeus and Enki are said to be the same person. And it's autographed and signed by Queen Semiramis. Now, let me even do you one better here. King Darius conquered Babylon. Now, again, keep in mind, these bloodlines and Bush and the Bushes and all these families connecting back to Darius. And you had King Nebuchadnezzar in that was in power in Babylon. Now, Saddam Hussein called himself the reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar, didn't he? And so King Darius went and conquered Babylon. And when he conquered Babylon, he slaughtered 3,000 Babylonians. And crucified King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, what did old Bushy Boy do? He brought down Babylon, didn't he? He was in charge when 9/11 happened. 3,000, about how many died on 9/11? Around 3,000, right? Yeah, well, 3,000 dead Babylonians at the hands of King Darius. And then, what, they have a public execution where they hung him in front of everybody? Same thing they did to King Darius, to Nebuchadnezzar. Starting to see these eerie connections here. Not to mention the Bush's connections to the Nazis and to, you know, Brown Brothers Harriman and funding the Nazis and all this stuff and Hitler looking for these Aryans. Well, this is what it is, folks. That's the real reason behind all the wars. It's not just about the oil. It's not just about the New World Order. See, this is what Alex Jones won't tell you. These white supremacists, that's why the truth movement is so infested with white supremacists, folks. They want to take over the lands that they believe belong to the white people, to the original bloodlines. You know, I mean, my God, Alex Jones in my film says, my bloodline's pure as the driven snow, folks. Quack, quack, quack. I mean, he says it right there. Don't you see what this is? This stuff is not a joke. This is why they hadn't want you to look into the bloodline things. This is why Jones and all those people tell you it's a distraction. That's why they tell you not to look into the Anunnaki stuff, not to look at the Zachariah Sitchin stuff, not to look at the ancient texts. They get us chasing our tails around the Constitution and running around about Ron Paul and left and right. Meanwhile, they're going on with the real business and continuing to keep all of us in the dark. They want to kill everybody that's not white, that they can't. Why do you think they have all these DNA databases? Why do you think they're collecting everybody's DNA? Because they're going to make race-specific bioweapons, and if your specific genome doesn't fall into what they consider to be pure, wiped out. And they're going to reseed and recolonize this planet at numbers that are sufficient to what we've heard them say, you know, Georgia Guidestones, et cetera, et cetera. And repopulate with the pure bloodlines as they existed in the days of ancient Sumeria. Now you may have a better idea why I feel so urgent about getting all of this information about getting these movies made and getting it out there to people, folks. I've dedicated my whole life to this. And I know for a fact now, I mean, that King Darius thing, when I found that out, man, that was a mind-blowing thing for me. Because it just made all the pieces fall together. That's why they want to go into Iran. That's why they went into Iraq. That's why Special Forces, the first thing they did when they got in the country is they went to the museum and they got the antiquities and the cylinder seals and all these, you know, statues of reptilian aliens and stuff like that. My God. What military advantages are they going in doing that? Wake up and pull your head out of your ass and realize that this isn't just conspiracy, kook, mumbo, jumbo, alien horse shit. This stuff's real, and they've been counting on you thinking it's all just sci-fi horse shit. Well, it's not. Unfortunately, I'd like it to be just as much as you, but unfortunately, that's not the truth. And I'm not going to fucking stick my head in the sand like an ostrich. As far as the significance of to secret society such as Freemasonry to King Darius and Cyrus, well, I mean, you know, again, they had the knowledge of the gods, and the ones that they put in positions of priesthood were the ones that they allowed to have access to this knowledge. The priests have always been the intermediaries between either the demigods or the gods themselves. And that's why it's time for us to shake the fucking answers out of these fuckers. I mean, come on, how hard is it to take a priest anyway? I mean, they're all brown boys, and they can't be hard. I mean, come on. How hard is it to shake a priest and just get the info out of him? Really? But, yeah, awesome email, John. I hope that helps with your research. Sounding apocalyptic outside. The crazy weather going on. Oh man, this one just takes the cake. You know, we talk a lot about Alex Jones and about you know, this, the idea of these people like him, and their, one of their purposes being to make anybody who is a real researcher look like they're associated with clowns like Alex Jones and others. And that's what the whole Charlie Sheen thing was about, you know? That way, whenever you'd bring up 9/11, oh, you believe that stuff Charlie Sheen believes, don't you? You must be on drugs and into hookers like he is to believe that stuff. That's what it's designed to do. And now the UK, with their Alex Jones equivalent, is getting their taste of what it feels like to have your, you know, to be a researcher and to look into this stuff. And then have, you know, yourself associated with these fucking ass clown retards. And you got to stand up and separate your shit from that, like I did a long time ago, and say, not in my name. You're not associating me with that. I'm not on your team. He once claimed, this is from the Daily fucking Mail, folks. Okay? Nothing gets in a newspaper this big unless they want it to be there. So I'm going to say it right now, and I've been criticized in the past for this by people, and it's every time something comes out about it, I come out and say this, and then somebody criticizes me, and I don't know what it's going to take before people wake up to this guy, but fucking David Icke is not your friend. He is not that motherfucker. I think he is a reptile. He is a fucking reptilian vampire. It's just like all the John Birch Society guys going around calling everybody a fucking communist and everybody a fucking socialist when they are the communists and the socialists. Well, David Icke goes around and calls everybody the reptiles and lizards. He is a reptile. He is a lizard. Two encounters I had with that guy, both when I interviewed him, one when I went to his event in New Mexico, and both times felt that hypnotism and energy draining, energy vampirism was going on. He once claimed, this is in the Daily Mail, he once claimed he's the son of God and the world is run by alien lizards, but the story of David Icke's marriage breakdown is almost as weird. The audience in the theater in Times Square, New York, sat in reverential silence as David Icke took the stage and made his great revelation. Our planet, he declared, is secretly ruled by a race of reptile-like aliens. These reptiles, malevolent in nature, sometimes shapeshift into human form. The Queen, for example, is a reptilian. President Barack Obama, another. Bonkers, yes, but Icke's show in November, with tickets costing $50 a head, which was a sellout, as have been most of the other dates on his world tour, which ends in Britain later this year. Wherever he goes, thousands flock to see him. 20 years after the famous TV interview on Wogan, when the once-respected sports commentator became a national laughingstock for saying he was the son of God, Icke's brand of loopiness has proved more resilient and lucrative than anyone could have guessed. But there's one thing Icke has not yet talked about on his tour, and he does go on rather sometimes for 8 hours at a time, and that is the increasingly bitter divorce battle he's embroiled in with his second wife, Pamela Lee Richards. Or that one of the reasons they split up, according to Pamela, is that he became suspicious that she is a shape-shifting reptilian alien. I mean, I've got pictures. I'll have to put them up for you guys at some point. I need to make like a... I have pictures that I took of him, and when I started adding light to them and looking, I mean, you could see that this guy's not... He's not human, folks. He's not. He's absolutely not human. I'm telling you, David Icke is not human. And he's out there posing as a kook and a crazy, so that people who really, really do experience this stuff or talk about it and see it look like a crazy person like he is. He's absolutely a plant. Why do you think him and Alex Jones were bitter enemies and Alex Jones called him to turn the punch bowl? The next thing you know, they're best friends and going on each other's show, and I need to call David on the phone. Wah, wah, wah. They are working and singing from the same songbook. There's no question about it. God, I can't even stand to look at David Icke. He's such a reptile. He can't figure me out. He thinks I might be a reptilian, says Pamela. Of course I'm not. David and I had a deep connection. We were meant to be together, but he turned against me. I've been through utter bewilderment, pain, sorrow, and heartbreak. He's got this psychic who he talked about. He actually talked about this person on my show, and he's been consulting with this psychic for quite some time. And I believe this psychic, whoever this person is either his hypnotist, his handler, or both. It's just strange. I've heard multiple stories of him, you know, big life-changing experience things in his life that were all preceded by a visit with this, you know, quote unquote psychic person. That just reeks of mind control, psyops, MK Ultra stuff, folks. I mean, it really does. Okay, it's not speculation. Do your research and you will see that reeks. You know, big, huge, monumental, life-changing events all preceded by a visit with this same psychic. Come on. That's no coincidence. So, presumably, Pamela thinks her husband is crazy, a fraud, or is enjoying a great joke at the expense of a global conspiracy theorist. Well, actually, no. Pamela, in all other respects, an intelligent and articulate woman, also believes sinister forces lurk in dark corners. So much so that during the 11 years they spent together, she devotedly accompanied Icke on his travels, spreading the word. Every marriage is unique, but surely there is none to match the barminess of the union between David Icke and Pamela Lee Richards. I mean, nobody gets this many pages in a big fucking publication like the Daily Mail, folks, unless they want it to be there, unless it's an operation. I mean, give me a break. Pamela, 52, and the mother of a 24-year-old daughter from a previous marriage, met Icke in Jamaica in August of 1997. It was 6 years after the interview on Wogan, and Icke was still a national joke in Britain. Pamela, the daughter of an American fighter pilot. Oh, well. Yeah. I mean, you know. Oh, yeah. Her dad just happened to be American military. Yeah. I mean, give me a fucking break, guys. He worked in financial services and was attending a conference on the island. Icke was giving one of his talks at the same hotel. And Pamela was intrigued enough to attend and was mesmerized by what she heard. 3 months later, they met on the Caribbean island of Aruba, where Icke was giving another talk at a conference, and Pamela was on another business trip. The encounter was apparently even more auspicious. Before his trip, Icke had visited a psychic, there you go, who told him he was going to meet a lady from America who would ask him out to dinner and with whom he would be joined at the hip. She would be wearing a mauve gown. I mean, give me a fucking break, man. And then it happens, and you don't think that. Yeah, so whoever this psychic is, who I don't ever see them name, is obviously, you know, obviously we can consider that person to be his handler. You know, no question. My God, folks. You know, they almost got us again. And a lot of us out there who are still buying into this bullshit, folks, but thank God that a lot of us got ourselves pulled out of it. They almost got us again. You're welcome. That's all I can say. You're welcome. Because I'm really glad that I've been out here yelling and screaming about this stuff for so long. Because, oh man, it's just mind blowing, man. All these guys. I mean, you know, David Icke and Alex Jones. I mean, you understand how strange it was for me to be in this position, man, because I used to worship these guys. And to be one of the, you know, the only biggest people now speaking out against them, while at the same time still, you know, trying to expose the similar information, but showing what's being left out. I mean, I never thought I'd be here, man, you know? You told me 5 years ago this is what I'd be doing in 2012. I told you're out of your mind. But God damn, I mean, that just obviously that this stuff was all put together. He was put together with her for a reason. This is staged. The real question is why? There's really only one explanation, but the real question would be is why is the Daily Mail allowing this much space to be dedicated to this? And to me, the obvious answer and the only answer would have to be because, again, you know, if you shoot the messenger, it's a good attempt at killing the message. And again, that's their main goal. They want everybody to think that every person that researches this stuff and is trying to expose this is a nutter like Ike or Jones. And I got to tell you, that seriously hurts somebody like me who's trying to expose them, because then we get lumped in with them and it's not the same thing. But that's how that cognitive dissonance works, and they get everybody confused, not knowing who to believe and not to believe. Man, oh man, oh man. God, this is a long article. I'll keep going. The day before the talk, we passed each other by the pool of the hotel where he was speaking, and we were both staying. He stopped and said hello. We talked for a while, and I could feel a strong connection beginning. Later, when we got together, he told me he stopped because he thought, oh my God, this could be the one. The following day, I saw him again and invited him to dinner with a few friends. Afterwards, we walked along the pier and sat at the end of the walkway. It was there that being joined at the hip and inseparable became as real as it gets. Ike had once predicted that the end of the world would happen in 1997, was no doubt mightily relieved that his prediction did not come true, allowing him to pursue Pamela. It was not imminent. Yeah, exactly. You know, people forget about that. This, you know, he predicted the world was going to end in 97. And, you know, and then Jones is getting everybody hyped up about Y2K. Fear, 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 fear. See, that's what David Icke does. And that's how people don't notice it as much. Is that that's why he does these long, drawn-out talks. Because he's very strategic about where he places the fear and where he places the things that get you hyped up and get you, you know, pumping your fist in the air. And, yeah, we're going to kill the New World Order. Rah! And so what he does is that he sequences like the beginner level stuff first. In the middle of the talk, he dedicates to the reptilian part. And then the third part is like, you know, pep rally, go team, let's go kick the NWO's ass. That's how he sequences it. I mean, I've seen him live. That's how he does it. And that's brilliant, because what it does is the parts where he's instilling that fear, he's also saying very positive things to counteract with that, which doesn't make your brain get so worried about the fear impressions that are being made on your subconscious and conscious mind. And so then, as sort of the release at the end and to resolve it, it's, you know, go team, let's go get them. And Alex Jones uses a similar particular model. And so while David Icke may be considered to be less, less fear-mongering or less scare tactics or less negative as Alex Jones, he's actually just more careful and very selective about where he places his things that are going to initiate a fear response in you. Very tricky. But I'm not going to go on and read all this article. It's just way too long. But I'll drop it in the chat room for those of you who hadn't seen it. And it's up on my website right now. Man, Hydra put a pretty fucking funny picture up there with it. I had to laugh my ass off when I saw that. But yeah, you can go there and check that out at your own discretion. Mysterious winged structure from ancient Rome has been discovered. A recently discovered mysterious winged structure in England, which in the Roman period may have been used as a temple, presents a puzzle for archaeologists who say the building has no known parallels. Kind of like the rock wall. They've, you know, again, they're finding, you know, archaeological things that don't fit in with anything else they've ever found. Oh, so let's just call it a natural. It's just a natural formation. That's all it is. Built around 1,800 years ago, the structure was discovered in Norfolk in eastern England, just to the south of the ancient town of Venta Icenorum. The structure has two wings radiating out from a rectangular room that in turn leads to a central room. Generally speaking, during the Roman Empire, people built with a fixed repertoire of architectural forms, said William Bowden, a professor at the University of Nottingham, who reported the find in the most recent edition of the Journal of Roman Archaeology. The investigation was carried out in conjunction with the Norfolk Archaeology and Historical Research Group. The foundation of the two wings in the rectangular room was made of a thin layer of rammed clay and chalk. This suggests that the superstructure of much of the building was quite light, possibly timber and clay lump walls with a thatched roof. The central room, on the other hand, was made of stronger stuff, with its foundations crafted from lime mortar mixed with clay and small pieces of flint and brick. That sounds very similar to the rock wall. That section likely had a tiled roof. Roman tiles are very large things. They're very heavy. So that's, you know, again, that's what people are not, you know, they're, oh, this is Roman. It must be Roman. Well, no. What we're finding is there were, you know, civilizations that had Roman type architecture and things before the Roman period. Or who knows, you know, with all these weird time anomalies that are going on, it could be part of that as well. So they came back out and said that this guy who said there might be life on Venus was actually looking at a lens cap, which I thought was a really, really shitty, lame excuse. I mean, you might as well have just said swamp gas, dude. So while at first I was kind of like, yeah, you know, I don't know, there may not be anything to this. When they came out with that crappy explanation, that's when I was like, oh man, really? There's really is something to this. They're really going to be covering this up. God damn it. But I, you know, was talking about 2 or 3 years ago about the possibility of them terraforming Mars and spraying algae into the atmosphere to make it breathable. You know, this planet Vulcan, which is talked about in the Sumerian text, as well as this other planet of Nibiru. And Vulcan supposedly is on the other side of the sun, on the other side of Venus. It can't be seen from Earth. And Japan, year before last, sent a probe to go to Venus and then to go to the other side of the sun, exactly where this Icarus is. And it was called, that's what it was called. It was called the Icarus spacecraft. And so even then, it seemed like they were, you know, something's going on with Venus. They're monitoring something around that vicinity. Well, listen to this. This is from space.com. It says, celestial stunner, Venus to cross the face of the sun this year. See, I don't think this is a coincidence. On your 2012 calendar, be sure to put a big red circle around June 5th. On that day, a celestial occurrence will not be seen by human eyes until well into the 22nd century, will not be seen again until the year 2117, to be exact, will take place. The planet Venus will cross the face of the sun. Well, that's not symbolic at all. Nah, no, go back to bed, you dumb shit. Oh, yeah. Venus is going to cross in front of the sun. That don't mean nothing. You're stupid. Ain't nothing symbolic about that. Oh. Really? Oh, Venus crossing. Oh, no, it don't mean nothing. It's just them stupid star things. They do dumb things. People think it's important. Oh, my God. I hate when I lose my place. Where did it go? There it is. Through the balance of this winter season, as well as the spring of 2012, Venus will gradually climb higher in the sky and grow progressively brighter, eventually becoming an evening lantern for those commuting home from work and school. By the end of May 2012, however, Venus will be rapidly dropping back toward the sun's vicinity, ultimately to disappear as it makes the transition back into the morning sky. That transition day will come on June 5th, 2012. Normally, Venus would pass unseen, hidden in the brilliant glare of the sun, but not this time. From June 5th to the 6th, 2012, an exceedingly rare occurrence is to take place from here on Earth. we will be able to see Venus cross in front of the sun, making itself evident as a small black spot slowly moving across the solar disk. This is among the rarest of all astronomical events. This is galactic alignment, folks. We're here. This, you know, this is the real thing of 2012 that nobody wants to talk about because everyone wants to talk about doom and gloom and apocalypse. In fact, between the years 2000 BC and 4000 AD, there have been only 81 Venus transits. Humans have recorded witnessing only six of them in 1639, 1761, 1769, 1874, 1882, and most recently in 2004. It is not impossible that a transit of this planet might have once been seen by chance in ancient times near sunrise or sunset. Or perhaps some ancient observer with a keen eye viewing the sun on an unusually hazy day might have glimpsed Venus's dark image, reporting it as a dark mark on the sun of the solar disk. Soon after the transit of 1882 had taken place, the French astronomer Camille Flammarion, sometimes referred to as the Carl Sagan of the 19th century because of his many popular books and articles on astronomy, compiled a listing of transits running from 1631 to 2984. We see that astronomers do not allow themselves to be taken unawares, Flammarion wrote. Astronomy is, after all, the only science which enjoys the privilege of reading the future as it does the past and avails itself of it. The special details of the approaching transit of June 8th of the year 2004 have already been calculated with precision, as well as those of the transit of June 5th, 2012. And we might almost say that the various expeditions are arranged with the exception of the names of the astronomers who will take part in them. The circumstances of the transits of Venus repeat themselves with great exactness over a period of 243 years. The intervals between the individual transits and years currently go as follows. 8 plus 121.5 plus 8 plus 105.5 equals 243. In other words, a pair of transits may occur over a time span of just 8 years, but following the second transit, the next one will not occur again for more than a century. Transits of Venus occurred on December 9, 1874 and December 6, 1882. The upcoming Venus transit of June 5, 2012 is the first one since 2004. Should anyone miss it, it will unfortunately be a long wait once again until December 11th. 2117, when Venus will again pass in front of the sun a bit too far into the future for most of us. And, that's going to be a high. Boy, that's right. Isn't that right around the time when they're having, like, Bohemian Grove and Bilderberg Group, too? Shit. It is, isn't it? Right around that time when we're in June? Oh, man. Yeah. Boy, there'd be some rituals going on that day. Shit. I'd be worried more about that day than December 21st myself. Fuck. Really? Fucking Lucifer crossing over the sun, huh? Well, that's going to be a fun day. We're going to take a break, come back, and I'm going to hit a few more news stories for you, and then I am going to get into end of days by Zachariah Sitchin for you tonight as well. So glad each and every one of you could be with us here. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. And again, you can order my newest documentary film, The Secret Right, Volume 2, up there. And you can get it on DVD and Blu-ray, anything you want. It's all there. And please get a DVD and support our work. And please make a donation. We have just this week and a few more days following next week to meet our goal for our 2012 kickoff fundraiser. And that is to pay the bills and to also be able to have some travel expenses to go out and film for the newest documentary that I'm going to be working on about buried civilizations. So please help us out if you can. TheGlobalReality.com. Please help us meet our goal. We have to meet that full goal this month, folks, and we need your help to do so. And, we're going to have somebody out here, you know, like myself, who's giving a voice for those people that don't have voice. And many of you don't have a voice. And you know, that's part of why, one of the reasons I'm here. So please help out if you can. Stay with us, folks. This is The Global Reality. Show, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. TheGlobalReality.com is my website, and again, we have the Chipping Banner up there. That's how you support our work. We don't have commercials. We don't try to sell you anything. We are not attempting to make and capitalize off of people's fears of information. I want you to be informed. I don't want you to be in fear because of information, then the information is pointless. Because if you're in fear because of information, then you can't act, then you can't think right, then you can't research, you can't do anything because you're just scared. And that's a perfect opportunity to sell you something that will, you know, in some way help you stave off the New World Order. I'm not going to do that. And unfortunately, you know, the funding for a show like mine is pretty much limited to those type of things. You know, Pizza Hut and PepsiCo and all these companies, they're not going to sponsor a show like mine. That's just all there is to it. And, you know, I'm not going to get up here and hoot and holler and scream and yell and try to get you to be in fear about stuff you should be thinking rationally about just so you know, you can be sold some shit. And you ought to have a problem with anybody out there that does, to be honest with you. So bear that in mind, and please support our work. Real Grassroots Media, thegoldmorality.com. Chip and Banner's there. Donate button is there if you want to make a big donation, a small donation, whatever it is. Subscriptions are there. I have a Amazon list up there for stuff for the film, and that you can go. It's a wish list. You can pick something up off there. It'll get shipped directly to me. You can do that as a donation. Anything is accepted there. And the P.O. box is back up and working again for those people that absolutely can't use PayPal. The P.O. box is back up and working, and it's operational, so you can start sending stuff there again. Let's get into a few more news stories tonight, and then we'll move to our reading of Zachariah Sitchin's End of Days. This is greatness right here. This yet another just strange piece of information that makes you wonder why now, why would they be coming out with this? And as we know with NASA, the Never a Straight Answer agency, anything they tell us, you pretty much know the opposite of that is the truth. Well, here's your case in point. NASA debunks mysterious triangular UFO. Triangular UFOs are not fake. Now, they may be black op back engineered military hardware and not, you know, little green men from Zeta Reticuli, but either way, to say that the triangular shaped UFOs don't exist in any way, shape, or form is just absolute falsehood. There's too many eyewitnesses. I've seen them. I know people that have seen them. Who is it that told a story one time on my show about seeing one and being out in the middle of nowhere? Oh, Freeman. That's who it was. Yeah, one time I had Freeman on. He was talking about seeing one, I think in Utah or something, or Colorado or somewhere like that. I mean, they're out there. People have seen them. So here's NASA saying they absolutely don't exist, which tells you pretty much, okay, they do exist, and they're probably black op, you know, secret government technology. Once again, alien conspiracy theorists have attempted to use publicly available NASA images to prove that the space agency must be engaging in an elaborate UFO cover-up, and once again, they've been foiled by the laws of physics. This time, they called attention to a peculiar new footage captured by a telescope on board NASA's Stereo B spacecraft. One of a pair of probes parked on either side of the sun, which together provide a 360-degree view of the inner solar system. The footage shows Venus and Earth, there's Venus again, on the opposite side of the field of view, and a mysterious triangular object headed our way. Yeah, that's a big mothership from Nibiru, the Anunnaki are coming back on. You didn't know? Yeah. The streets will flow with the blood of the unbelievers. I am Cornholio. yeah, they're coming back. I'd love to make some t-shirts. That's what we need to do. Make some t-shirts, and they should be like, it should, you know, be like Anunnaki 2012, vote Anunnaki 2012, and have like, you know, an Anunnaki head on like some, you know, politician suit and tie. Vote for the destroyer 2012. Don't blame me. I voted for the Anunnaki. Oh, man. They already have Don't Blame Me. I voted for Crowley. That was pretty funny. So that's, you know, that's comforting, isn't it? That, I mean, I don't know, man. I don't know how I feel about that. That didn't really make me feel too good. I mean, you know, if there's a giant triangular object headed our way and NASA's saying, oh, no, it's nothing, it's horseshit. That kind of concerns me. Because you can't believe, I mean, seriously, NASA's like the government itself. Anything they say the opposite of is generally the truth, 98% of the time. Comparing it to the size to the planetary objects that are seen in this telescope, if my calculations here are correct, this thing is enormous. Said YouTube user BP Oil Disaster in his video commentary on the footage, which was captured December 27th through the 29th. Talk of a cover-up quickly followed. A few days later, NASA scientists updated the Stereo website to display newer images. This is not the first time alien hunters have found what they believe to be enormous UFOs and images captured by the Stereo probes. But this time, the team of scientists who worked with the data from the probes decided to address the claim directly. Oh. So in the past, they didn't. But with this one, they felt a special need to come publicly out and debunk it. See, that right there is your key. That's interesting. So they admit right there that this is not the first time alien hunters have found what they believe to be enormous UFOs, but normally NASA doesn't respond. In the case of this one, they did respond publicly. That is the story right there. Forget all this other stuff. That's the story. That's the story. See, that's what you have to do when you read these. You have to, you know, you have, sometimes you have to read to find what the story really is. That's the story. The story is that this has happened before and they don't normally respond, but to this specific case, they felt the need to respond. There's something to that. In a post on the Stereo website, the researchers offered up an explanation of the triangular feature on the December footage. The researchers say it's no more than a trick of light. Oh, man. See? God damn it. Man, I don't want to believe this stuff. You know, I don't want to believe the Anunnaki are coming back from Nibiru and, you know, or, you know, but my God. I also can't ignore stuff like, you know, swamp gas. You just can tell when they're telling you, if you just know what how to read the right words and see what they're saying, you can tell when they're giving you bullshit. A trick of light. Oh, man, that's swamp gas and Chinese lanterns. Come on. The answer lies on the exact opposite side of the image, the scientist wrote. At the same time as this strange-looking feature starts being visible, the very bright planet Venus enters the telescopic camera's field of view from the lower left. The scientists note that Venus and the triangle opposite each other across the middle of the camera plane stay in step as they move. This is not a coincidence. The strange-looking geometrical object is actually an internal reflection of the planet Venus within the telescope optics. The effect has been seen many times before. In this optical effect, incoming light reflects back and forth off lenses and mirrors inside the telescope. The shape of the artifacts produced by this scattered light, usually triangles and circles of various sizes, depends on the relative orientations of those lenses and mirrors. So it's, you know, it's lenses and mirrors, it's a telescope. Believe NASA. They've never lied. And you know what? That may very well be what it is. It may be all it is. Maybe that is what it is. But if that's what it is, then what's the big deal? Why would you have to publicly come out to say that's what it is? You know what I mean? Generally, when people are that off the mark about stuff, they just ignore it. And they just say, oh, that's just idiot conspiracy theories. Let's not even give them a time of day. But no, in this case, they felt the need to go public and publicly try to come out with something to debunk it. That's the story, man. That's very interesting. Very, very interesting. Definitely more to that than meets the eye. Absolutely. You know, every time I joke about something on the show, I joke about, you know, the iBrain. Download wireless internet into your brain 24 hours a day. The new iBrain from Mac. Every time I joke about something, you know, I was just joking about that, last week? Week before? Every time I joke about something, the next week I found a news story about it. I need to quit joking around. The name of this article is, "This is a wireless router for your brain and it shoots lasers." That's a hell of a name for an article. This is a wireless router for your brain and it shoots lasers. End of story. You ready for this? Optogenetics is a method of using light to control cells in the brain. It can be used to alter behavior, model diseases, and maybe even one day deliver drugs right where you need them. And now it's wireless with lasers. With genetic engineering, we can design cells that respond to light from lasers or LEDs by activating or deactivating themselves or otherwise changing their functionality. The appeal of using light to alter cells is that we can turn light on and off at the speed of, you know, light, which allows us to keep up with the speeds at which things happen inside our cells. Brain lasers and wireless routers. I mean, that's, we're here now. But you know, I've thought about that so many times, and I think that very well could be a possibility. You know, if there was actually something to these, you know, to the return of the Anunnaki or something, you know, you would just have to think that that's something they'd be pushing. They'd be pushing the, you know, the transhumanist thing. And it makes you wonder, because you know, a lot of people believe that these Anunnaki who never left Earth, who stayed behind, have actually been in charge and running the show ever since, and have done so from places like, you know, Shambhala and Inner Earth and places like that, where you know, these rulers have still been staying on Earth, and that you know, the argument has been made that that could possibly be why we're seeing this push to transhumanism emerging with machines, is because that's what these, you know, Anunnaki who've been behind on Earth have wanted. And, you know, it kind of does make sense. I don't know if I absolutely believe that, but I wouldn't say I absolutely disbelieve it, because they, you know, I mean, think about it. These were the guys who were the original transhumanists, you know? According to these ancient texts, these guys were the, you know, they were the one, they were using technology and all this stuff to, you know, genetically manipulate various creatures, and in the text it talks about more than just, you know, humans, and they tinkered around with all kinds of different things. And so it kind of seems that the transhumanist thing is almost an extension of that original Anunnaki thing of enhancing and tinkering humans and extending it. And, you know, I think that's going to be for the people who are, I mean, it kind of makes you wonder if that's what the whole trick to this bloodline thing has been about, that which why they've been interbreeding and maintaining these bloodlines for years, so that when the return or the rulers do come, everybody that's actually of the bloodline will have a seat at the table, which means they get to live, and everybody who's not dies. It's just something I've thought about, you know. Well, we're going to. They're also releasing new the last of the secret JFK tapes this week. I haven't heard any of the audio yet, or seen where you can go and find that audio yet. But I did want to mention that. Yeah, secret JFK audio tapes going to be released this week as well. All right, let me get the book going here. All right. The ensuing 24 years from 2048 to 2024 BCE were a time of religious fervor, ferment of international diplomacy and intrigue, of military alliances and clashing armies, of a struggle for strategic superiority. The spaceport in the Sinai Peninsula and the other space-related sites were constantly at the core of events. Amazingly, various written records from antiquity have survived, providing us not just with an outline of events, but with great details about the battles, the strategies, the discussions, the arguments, the participants, and their moves, and the crucial decisions that resulted in the most profound upheaval on Earth since the deluge. Augmented by the date formulas and varied other references, the principal sources for reconstructing those dramatic events are the relevant chapters in Genesis, Marduk's autobiography known as the Marduk Prophecy, a group of tablets in the Spartoli collection in the British Museum known as the Kedorla Omar texts, and a long historical autobiographical text dictated by the god Nergal to a trusted scribe in a text known as the Era Epos. As in a movie, usually a crime thriller in which the various eyewitnesses and principals describe the same event, not exactly the same way, but from which the real story emerges, so we're able to reach the same result in this case. Marduk's main chess move in 2048 BCE was to establish his command post in Haran. By that, he took away from Nanar-Sin his vital northern crossroads and severed Sumer from the northern lands to the Hittites. Besides the military significance, the move deprived Sumer of its economically vital commercial ties. The move also enabled Nabu to marshal his cities toward the Great Sea to set his course. Place names in these texts suggest that the principal cities west of the Euphrates River were coming under full or partial control of the father-son team, including the all-important landing place. It was into the most populated part of the lands of the West, Canaan, that Abraham was commanded to go. He left Haran, taking his wife and nephew Lot with him. He was traveling swiftly southward, stopping only to pay homage to his God at selected sacred sites. His destination was the Negev, the dry region bordering the Sinai Peninsula. He did not stay there long. As soon as Shugli's successor, Amar-Sin, was enthroned in Ur in 2047 BCE, Abram was instructed to go to Egypt. He was at once taken to meet the reigning pharaoh and was provided with sheep and oxen and asses and male attendants and female servants and she-asses and camels. Well, you just said he had female servants. You didn't have to say he had she-asses. I mean, we get it. Oh, she-donkeys. I'm sorry. I've just never heard the term she-asses before. Let's go get some she-ass, gentlemen. The Bible is mum regarding the reason for this royal treatment, except a hint that the pharaoh, being told that Sarai was Abram's sister, assumed that she was being offered to him in marriage, a step that suggests that a treaty was discussed, that such high-level international negotiations were taking place between Abram and the Egyptian king seems plausible when one realizes that the year when Abram returned to the Negev after a 7-year stay in Egypt, 2040 BCE, was the very same year in which the Theban princes of Upper Egypt defeated the previous Lower Egypt dynasty, launching Egypt's unified Middle Kingdom. Another geopolitical coincidence. Abram, now reinforced with manpower and camels, returned to the Negev in the nick of time. His mission now clear to defend the fourth region with its spaceport. As the biblical narrative reveals, he now had with him an elite force of Nerim, a term usually translated to young men. But Mesopotamian texts use the parallel term lunar, Narmen, to denote armed cavalrymen. It is my suggestion that Abraham, having learnt in Haran tactics from the military excelling Hittites, obtained in Egypt a striking force of swift camel-riding cavalrymen. His base in Canaan was again the Negev, the area bordering the Sinai Peninsula. He did so in the nick of time, for a mighty army, legions of an alliance of Inlite kings, was on its way, not only to crush and punish the sinning cities that switched allegiance to other gods, but also to capture the spaceport. The Sumerian text dealing with the reign of Amar-Sin, Shulgi's son and successor, inform us that in 2041 BCE, he launched his greatest and last military expedition against the lands of the West that fell under the Marduk-Nabu spell. It entailed an invasion of unparalleled scope by an international alliance in which not only cities of men, but also strongholds of gods and their offspring were attacked. It was indeed such a major and unparalleled occurrence, but the Bible devoted a whole long chapter to it, Genesis chapter 14. Biblical scholars call it the War of the Kings, for it climaxed in a great battle between an army of four kings of the East and the combined forces of five kings of the West, and culminated in a remarkable military feat by Abraham's swift cavalrymen. The Bible begins its report of that great international war by listing the kings and kingdoms of the East who came and made war in the West. And it came to pass in the days of Aramphal, king of Shinar, Arioka, king of Elasar, Kedorah, Omar, king of Elam, and Tidehall, the king of Goyim. The tablets named the Kedorah Omar text was first brought to scholarly attention by Assyriologist Theophilus Pinches in a lecture at the Victoria Institute, London, in 1897. They clearly describe the same events that are the great international war of chapter 14 of Genesis, though in much greater detail. It is quite possible indeed that those tablets served as the source for the biblical writers. Those tablets identify Kedorlaomer, king of Elam, as the Elamite king Kedorlaomer, who is known from historical records as Arioka, and has been identified as Eriaku, the servant of the moon god, who reigned in the city of Larsa and Tidal, and was identified as Tud-Gula, a vassal of the king of Elam. There has been over the years a debate regarding the identity of the Aframel king of Shinar. Suggestions ranged all the way from Hammurabi, a Babylonian king centuries later. Shinar was the constant biblical name for Sumer, not Babylon. So who in the time of Abraham was its king? I have convincingly suggested in the Wars of Gods and Men that the Hebrew should be read not Amarafel, but Amarfel, from the Sumerian Amarpal and variant of Amar-Sin, whose date formulas attest that he did indeed in 2041 BCE launch the War of the Kings. The fully identified coalition, according to the Bible, was led by the Elamites, a detail corroborated by the Mesopotamian data that highlights the re-emerging leading role of Ninurta in the struggle. The Bible also dates this Cledora-Omer invasion by observing that it took place 14 years after the previous Elamite incursion into Canaan, another detail confirming to the data from Shulgi's time. The invasion route this time was, however, different, shortcutting the distance from Mesopotamia by a risky passage through a stretch of desert. The invaders avoided the densely populated Mediterranean coastland by marching on the eastern side of the Jordan River. The Bible lists the places where those battles took place and who the Elamite forces were that battled there. The information indicates that an attempt was made to settle accounts with old adversaries, descendants of the intermarrying Igigi, even the usurper of Zu, who evidently supported the uprisings against the Elamites. But sight was not lost of the prime target, the spaceport. The invading forces followed what was known as, that has been known since biblical times, as the Way of the King, running north-south on the eastern side of the Jordan. But when they turned westward toward the gateway to the Sinai Peninsula, they met a blocking force, Abraham and his cavalrymen. Referring to the peninsula's gateway city, Dur Ma-Elani, the god's great fortified place, the Bible called it Kadesh Barnea, the Cledora Omer text clearly stated that the way was blocked there. The son of the priest anointed by the gods, I suggest, was Abraham, the son of the priest Terah. A date formula tablet belonging to Amar-Sin, inscribed on both sides, boasts of destroying Neburim, the shepherding place of Iburim. In fact, at the gateway to the spaceport, there was no battle. The mere presence of Abraham's cavalry striking force persuaded the invaders to turn away to richer and more lucrative targets. But if the reference is indeed to Abraham by name, it offers once more an extraordinary extra-biblical corroboration of the patriarchal record, no matter who claimed victory. Prevented from entering the Sinai Peninsula, the army of the east turned northward. The Dead Sea was then shorter. Its current southern appendix was not yet submerged. And it was then a fertile plain, rich with farmland, orchards, and trading centers. The settlements there included five cities, among them the infamous Sodom and Gomorrah. Turning northward, the invaders now faced the combined forces of what the Bible called five sinning cities. It was there, the Bible reports, that the four kings fought and defeated the five kings, looting the cities and taking captives with them. The invaders marched back, this time on the western side of Jordan. The biblical focus on these battles might have ended with that turning back were it not for the fact that Abraham's nephew Lot, who resided in Sodom, was among the captives. When a refugee from Sodom told Abraham what happened, he armed his trained men, 318 of them, and gave chase. His cavalry caught up with the invaders all the way north near Damascus, where Lot was freed and the booty recovered. He said booty. They recovered the booty. Yeah, well, forget what happened to Lot. Make sure you get that booty. The Bible records the feat as the smiting of Cledora Omer and the kings who were with him by Abraham. The historical record suggests that as audacious and far-flung as that War of the Kings had been, it failed to surpass the Marduk-Nabu surge Amar Sin, we know, died in 2039 BCE, felled not by an enemy lance, but by a scorpion's bite. He was replaced in 2038 BCE by his brother Shusin. The data for his 9-year reign record 2 military forays northward, but none westward. They speak mostly of his defensive measures. He relied mainly on building new sections of the wall of the west against attacking Amorites. The defenses, however, were moved each time ever closer to Sumer's heartlands, and the territory controlled from Ur kept shrinking. By the time the next and last of the Ur the Third Dynasty, Ibibi-Sin, ascended to the throne, invaders from the west had broken through the defensive wall and were clashing with Ur's foreign legion. They were clashing with Ur's foreign legion Elamite troops in Sumerian territory. Targeting and prompting the Westerners on toward the cherished target was Nabu. His divine father, Marduk himself, was waiting in Haran for the recapture of Babylon. And of course, we know Marduk is Ra, and Ra just wanted to rule everything. The great gods called to an emergency council, then approved extraordinary steps that changed the future forever. So that's the end of chapter 5. The next chapter we'll start on tomorrow is Gone with the Wind. And this gets into the unleashing of the terror weapons and the nuclear weapons in the time of ancient Sumeria. And that's gonna be very interesting. Can't wait to get in that. Man, oh man, oh man. That's why I do this. That's why I get up every day and research this stuff. I just can't stress enough, no matter how much you know, there's always more to know. And never give up. Never think that you know everything there is to know. And never think that you can't do something. The things that we do have repercussions beyond what we can ever see. But the most important thing is, at the end of the day, when you've shuffled off this mortal coil, you want to be able to say you did something, that you tried, that you just didn't let it go and happen without trying to do something, win or lose. And I'm glad that those of you out there have chosen to stand by my side in all this. I appreciate that. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. We have the chip-in banner, the donate button, everything up there. That's how you support our work. You can also get a DVD or Blu-ray of The Secret Rite Volume 2, my newest film that exposes the real forces that are acting like they're perpetrating the truth, but are really indeed working for the New World Order they claim to be exposing. And you got to see this film. It's a very important piece of work, and it's definitely a caliber above everything else I've ever put out. That's for damn sure. All right, TheGlobalReality.com. My name is Josh Reeves, and I love each and every one of you, and we'll see you tomorrow. You guys have a great one. Take care.